Estás escuchando Radio 7 Costa Blanca.
It's July 1961. The British group The Shadows dominate the charts, and the Beatles have by now settled into a four-piece unit. They've been to Hamburg twice and have cut their first commercial record there, backing Tony Sheridan. Their own sound is developing. Part two, getting it onto wax. The four members of the group on their return from Hamburg were John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Pete Best, Stu Sutcliffe having stayed in Germany as an art student. Now, as you've just heard, during the previous months in Hamburg, the boys had cut one session for the German A&R man Bert Kempfert. Bob Wooler, who was the DJ at the Cavern and other ballrooms.
Well, I was trotting along to Entry Institute, as was my wont on a Saturday night. That was my Saturday night scene, and the Beatles were booked there on this particular Saturday night, and George was on the same bus that night. He said, "I've got a copy of record which Stuart has sent to us." The singer was Tony Sheridan, who they knew very well in Hamburg, and they actually backed him. Of course, they were made up by this, because if you're on any record, that's important to you. You feel important, you see. I begged it off him, and I said, "Look, I want to play this wherever I go." Well, he knew I toured the circuit. Well, I used to urge people to go to record stores, and I used to say to them, "Look, for heaven's sake, go and buy this copy. It's called My Bonnie."
This early plugging of the disc by Bob Wooler had a far-reaching effect. In Liverpool, there were two very successful businesses called the North End Music Stores, which were owned by the Epstein family, the father, Harry, and two sons, Clive the younger and Brian the elder. Brian looked after the record side of the business, and in October, a young man called Raymond Jones walked into the shop when Brian happened to be there.
We were asked, or I was asked, by a young boy for a record by a group by the Beatles, and it always had been our policy in records to look after whatever request was made. And I followed up this inquiry. I didn't know anything about it, and it was only after a week or two that he told me that they were in fact a Liverpool group. I assumed for some reason that they were from Germany. Anyway, he told me that they were a Liverpool group and that they'd just in fact returned from Germany, and that they were playing in a club called The Cavern, about 100 yards away from my office, and I arranged to go down there, and I saw them one midday session.
Ah! Alistair Taylor was one of Brian Epstein's assistants and went with him on that first visit to the cavern.
We had a very brief meeting with them in the band room after the set. And he said, you know, can you come to the shop and talk? We might be able to talk management. And they were quite interested, and we went off for lunch afterwards. And it was sort of Panicsville. You know, what does managing a group mean? Can we do it?
Not the most business-like way to start what was to be one of the biggest music empires. Back in the summer of 1961, different music could be heard in the charts. The Shadows with Contiki. The Beatles brought with them for moral support their disc jockey friend from the cavern, Bob Wooler.
Now, I felt as though, what am I doing here? And Brian was looking very sort of quizzical at me, and eventually John realised, well, the intros hadn't been completed, and John introduced me as, this is me dad.
And no one recorded Brian's reply to John's wit, but Alistair Taylor was there for the signing.
It was agreed that, subject to various parents' approval, that he would become their manager. So it was then, when they'd gone, we had to think, how do you draw up a contract? What is a contract? At which point we called up a lawyer and said, what does an artist contract mean? And we took it from there. Well, we called the boys in to the office on a famous celebratory occasion. And I was called in to witness this first contract of the Beatles and Brian Epstein, which I duly did. I signed it in five places. And it was quite a long time afterwards when Brian wrote his book and photostated the original contract, that although I signed it five times, there were only four signatures. So I witnessed a non-existent signature because Brian never did sign that contract, ever.
Signed contract or not, Brian soon got things moving. Clive Epstein, Brian's brother.
The earliest activities, of course, were connected with the Beatles. But to give the company some reputation and to get Brian more involved with the pop scene generally, he started hiring the halls at Widnes, in Lee, in New Brighton, and started promoting concerts.
They had a jubilee. Then Georgia folks, they had a jamboree. They're drinking home from a wooden cup. The folks are dancing, they got all shook up. I started playing that rock and roll music. Any old time you use it, it's got a back beat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it, gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me, don't get to hear them play a tango, and in the mood they take a mambo. It's way too early for the condo, so keep a rockin' that piano. That's why I go for that rock and roll music. Any old time you use it, it's got a black beat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it, oh, they got rock and roll music.
rock and roll music, something they were all very much into in the autumn of 1961. Neil Aspinall was still ferrying the boys about in his van, but the dates were becoming better organised. Before each one, Brian Epstein gave them a slip of paper with all the details typed out. And there were some changes in their style of dress, too.
I encouraged them at first to get out of leather jackets and jeans, and I wouldn't allow them to appear in jeans after a short time. And then after that step, I got them to wear, I think, sweaters on stage. And then, very reluctantly, eventually suits. I think it was for their one of their first sort of major appearances. I'm not sure they didn't wear their first suits for a BBC broadcast to a live audience.
Back in the cavern, though, the boys had a few problems with their suits. Bob Wooler.
I was there dutifully doing the commercials at the cavern. The Beatles will be appearing in their new suits. For the very first time on Merseyside, the Beatles appear in suits. And came the night, and of course it was jam-packed, it was a sweat box, and everyone sweated, you see. And they went on stage and they sweated, and all their suits began to rot, as it were. Come apart at the seams, and they said to Brian, this is ridiculous, and all that. And of course, he was furious because he hadn't got sweat-proof suits for them. But that was the beginning, you see. Everything had to have a beginning, and they were to adjust, and they learned how to bow, you see. And we even did it at the cavern, and their fans were rapturous.
On Beatles nights, queues used to form the night before, and they'd fight to get in and throw their money to get in. If you walked down when the show was on, you walked into Matthew Street, nobody need tell you where the cavern was. You just looked along Matthew Street, and you'd see a doorway with clouds of steam coming out. And that steam was heat generated just by the bodies of those youngsters down below. If you had to go in, as you walked down the steps, it was like stepping into a hot bath, and then you had to fight your way to the band room. Well, you'd have had to see that band room to really believe it, because it was so ridiculously small, and you'd get four and five groups crowding in there. But as you tried to get through the crowd to get to the band room, you were conscious of their bodies being wringing wet with sweat. The heat must have been around 100 degrees, and the kids used to come out of there, spill out into the street, and they were just a picture of happiness. They'd seen their idols.
Paul wrote most of that one, but John made a small yet important contribution.
Actually, what happened was he took out one word, which would have made it very wrong. The first two lines, I did it going home in a car one night, and so I wasn't really thinking too much about it. The first two lines originally were, she was just 17, and she'd never been a beauty queen, which sort of just sounded like it rhymed to me. Anyway, when I saw it the next day and played it through to John, I realised that it was a useless line, you know. So we just sat down and tried to think of another line which rhymed with 17 and meant something. We eventually got, you know what I mean, which means nothing. Means completely nothing at all.
The song, though, was a good one, and typical of more that were to follow. They were, by that Christmas of 1961, playing many ballrooms further afield, as well as the regular dates in the Cavern. And Neil Aspinall says that never once in all those bookings did they miss a single show. And on only one occasion, when Paul was ill, were they late going on in Bournemouth. The Beatles topped the Merseybeat poll that year over their rivals Jerry and the Pacemakers and Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Interest in the group was spreading. Brian Epstein was doing his best to get someone to make a British recording of the group in its own right. And just before the new year, Decca's A&R manager, Mike Smith, came to hear them for himself. He went away from the Cavern in a very enthusiastic mood. But instead of a contract came a message that Decca didn't like their sound and wasn't prepared to record them. However, they didn't give up hope. Brian decided to try elsewhere, and there were some promising offers of work from the German club owners. Their last visit to Peter Eckhorn's Top Ten Club had gone very well, and he naturally wanted them back again. The rival Star Club was to open in the spring. Its owner, Manfred Weisslieder, gave the manager, Horst Fascher, his orders.
Okay, before we open the club, you go over to England and get groups booked in advance, 3-4 months in advance. And then I told him about the Beatles. I said the Beatles were in Hamburg in the top 10, and they went down so well, and Eckhorn is planning to get the Beatles back. If I would go over now and try to get the Beatles for the Star Club, we would have the biggest opening we could ever think of. So he gave me money in his pocket and said, okay, get the Beatles, it doesn't matter how much it costs, go and get the Beatles. And then I went again with Roy Young to Liverpool to get the Beatles. But in that time, already Brian Epstein signed up the Beatles and the manager. So we had to go to Brian Epstein to deal with him. We told him all about the Beatles, that we want to open a club called Star Club. We had already a name, but the name was not published yet. And we are interested to book the Beatles and the opening band. And he said, yeah, but we give already our word to Peter Eckhorn, and we can't cancel that and things like that. And I said, yeah, okay, we pay you any money you're asking for, because we must have the Beatles and things like that, because Weisslieder told me like that. And then he told me something about that the Beatles were getting a week, each of them 450 marks. And I offered him 600. A week to sign up for the Star Club. And then we made a deal, and it was set that the Beatles came to the opening on the 13th of April 62 to the Star Club Hamburg.
Yourself by every rock and roll book on a magazine stand. Every time that he gets, oh, he's off to the jukebox man. Well, he worries and teases her till at night she's ready to poop. From rocking and a rolling, spinning in a hula hoop. Junior, behave yourself.
Bad boy. And that was the sort of sound that the shrewd Herr Weisslieder had so rightly assessed would start proceedings with a bang. The only shadow over that opening night was the sad news that their former bass player and friend Stu Sutcliffe had died a few days before in a Hamburg hospital. Always artistic, he and his fiancée Astrid had contributed much to the way the Beatles looked and thought at that time. It's impossible to say for sure, but had he lived, Stuart would probably have been a very successful painter. While the boys worked on in Germany, Brian Epstein in London continued his round of the record companies with his tapes. Only one man was really willing to listen, George Martin, and he promised the Beatles a studio audition on their return to England. Brian was cock-a-hoop and sent a cable to Hamburg with the news, and then flew out himself to sort out the recording material with the boys. They came home at the beginning of June, and on June the 6th, 1962, did their audition session for George Martin.
Well, when I first met them, I'd already heard a tape that they'd done, which, frankly, wasn't very impressive. It had bad sound on it, and the songs weren't very brilliant. I don't think they were actually Beatle compositions. But there was something peculiar about it that I thought was rather interesting. So I thought, well, let's get them down to the studio and have a look at them. So Brian brought them down from Liverpool, and I was immediately impressed by them as people, not particularly as musicians, but I liked them. You know, they were most engaging people. They had that kind of irreverent sense of humour, which I also nurse, and I thought they were super people to be with. And incidentally, I thought that they sang in a very unusual and very engaging style also. So I thought, well, let's put them under contract. I can't lose much. And that was the beginning of them.
So it looked good. They went back to Liverpool to wait for a letter from George Martin.
Hey, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Hey, wait, hey, Mr. Postman. Mr. Postman, look and see. Oh yeah, back for me, please, Mr. Postman. Oh yeah, since I heard from the gallop, there must be some words and days from my girlfriend. You didn't.
In the meantime, they had a problem, a serious one. This concerned their drummer, Pete Best.
They decided that Pete would have to go out of the group. We held a meeting in a late pub after hours, and we discussed it. The reason I was there, I was invited because Brian wanted my advice, because he didn't want to alienate any of the fans, you see, and Pete had his following. You see, and it was a very crucial period because they'd been to London and they'd done these tapes, but apparently Pete's drumming ability was not in favour with the recording studio. And the Beatles, apparently, not all of them were present that night, but they said, Pete must go. And it was decided amongst them that his logical successor would be Ringo Starr.
Ringo Starr, so called because of the many rings on his fingers, had stood in from time to time when Pete Best was unwell. At the time the decision was made, he was playing at a holiday camp in Skegness with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, old friends of the Beatles from their Hamburg days. George Harrison of the Liverpool Echo.
So Brian said, right, well, look, I'll get in touch with Ringo. And he knew, as they all did, that Ringo had been dying for a year or more to get into the Beatles. So they got in touch with Ringo. Ringo came at once, of course, hot foot to Liverpool. And there they made the decision that Pete Best would have to be told, unfortunately, that they didn't want him and that Ringo Starr would take over as the drummer in the Beatles.
As Bob Wooler said, Pete Best had a big personal following, and his fans weren't going to be too happy to see their drumming man being given the order of the boot. Brian's mother, Queenie Epstein, and his brother Clive.
Brian hated having to tell Pete Best, didn't he?
Well, certainly.
Yes,
he
was very distressed about it.
Also, Brian needed protection when he went to the cavern.
And let me tell you that I was most distressed.
Actually, it was a pity that it did reflect upon Brian, because it wasn't Brian. I mean, the boys were... Brian did it as the manager, but it was really the boys who agreed these arrangements with Brian.
So it was settled. Ringo shaved off his beard, got himself a Beatles suit, and started to play with them.
Radio 7, Costa Blanca. Je blij gevoel radio.
From that first night at the cavern with Ringo on drums, we've managed to find one recording that was made by a TV company for a news broadcast. This is the actual cavern sound of John, Paul, George and Ringo in August 1962. There you could no doubt hear some of the more vociferous Pete Best supporters shouting, "We want Pete." But despite the fans' protests, the new drummer was there to stay. His real name, Richard Starkey. Richard, Richie, or Ringo, as he eventually came to be called, was born on July the 7th, 1940. His parents separated and divorced a few years later, and his mother remarried in 1953. Ringo himself suffered from ill health quite a lot during his youth, but developed an interest in music whilst in hospital.
When I was about 14 in hospital, they used to have to keep us happy, you know, all the kids, because I was 14. They had a sort of ward band, and the teacher came along, and she sort of put a big board up with all yellow dots and red dots, and when she pointed to red or yellow or green, the triangles or the drums or, you know, silly little band. It was great fun. Yeah. And I would never play unless you gave me a drum, you see. Mm-hmm. So I used to fight for the drums then. And I think that's when I first became interested. And then I used to sort of bang on a desk on the locker next to the bed and things. And then I came home and I put little bits of wire on top of biscuit tins and used to bash them with pieces of firewood, you know. And then I got a 30-bob bass drum, which used to drive them all mad. I was about 15 and a half, I think, 16. And I got this bass drum, you know, just a one-sided bass drum, and I used to bang it sort of bashing it to the BBC and things like that.
Did you ever have any kind of tuition at all, or was the whole thing?
I had about three lessons. I sort of, once I got interested and sort of said, every night I'll go and read music and learn how to play, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And only I went to this little man in, you know, it was just in a house sort of thing, and he played drums, and he sort of said, get a manuscript, and he wrote it all down. And I never went back, you know. After that, I couldn't be bothered, you know. It was too routine for me, you know, all the paradiddles and that, and I couldn't stand it.
I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna be your man. Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man. Tell me that you love me, baby, let me understand. Tell me that you love me, baby, I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby, I wanna be your man. I wanna be your lover, baby, I wanna be your man. I want to be your man, I want to be your man, I want to be your man, I want to be your man. Wow! No! Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man, I wanna be your man.
Well, we started in work, and then we did a few weddings, you know, someone we knew would get married, and we'd fetch the gear along and play for a few hours. The greatest one, a pal of ours, just a guy in work, said, you've got to come and play at this wedding, and can I join the group if I get you the booking? And so he joined the group to get us this booking, and he said, we're going to be all right. It's a fur coat wedding, which is a big scene, fur coats. And we're saying, okay, and he's saying, you know, it's all shorts. There'd be none of that beer. It's really a big wedding. And we got there, and they were all out at the pub when we arrived to set up, and they all came back with medicine bottles full of brown ale. You know, it's really like the roughest wedding I've ever been to. But he was like, oh, it's a real fur coat, dude. We played that, and they were all, you know, we were all sort of just little lads, and they were saying, do you want a drink? Like, oh, no, thanks. You know, they're all out the bottles. All a bit proud.
Yeah.
You want to drink out of your medicine bottle? You've got a glass.
Ringo talking to Anne Nightingale. He later joined Rory Storm's group, The Hurricanes, and, as we said earlier, first met the Beatles in Hamburg. He'd also worked as the backing drummer to Tony Sheridan in Germany when the Beatles were at the Star Club, so he was quite well acquainted with them and their music by the time he joined the group in August 1962. In that same month, John Lennon married Cynthia Powell, a girl he'd known since art college. Brian Epstein persuaded Bert Kempfert to release the Beatles from their contract with him so that they were now free to sign with George Martin and Parlophone. At this stage, they didn't have a British publisher for their songs. It was through George that they came to know the man who was going to fill that role, Dick James. Dick had recently formed his own publishing company and one day took a song to George Martin for him to record with one of his acts.
And he agreed with me that it was a good song, a cute song, and he said he'd try it with a new group that he was trying out. It was a group from Liverpool. My retort, I remember very clearly, was, what's from Liverpool? And he said, well, they're four boys, unusual types. He has heard them, he has met them, and he was bringing them down to London for the first session to see what they could do and experiment to see what kind of recordings he could get.
The session actually took place during the week beginning 4th of September 1962. Norman Smith, the recording engineer, now a record producer for EMI.
Ringo had just joined the group and wasn't too familiar with things. And I remember he sat in the corner with his black leathers on and made a very pathetic looking figure. Didn't say anything at all, from what, you know, what I recall. And I think that he did attempt to put a track down, drumming track down, to this Love Me Do song. But for various reasons, it wasn't, it didn't come off. And we finished up with a session drummer, Andy White.
Two numbers emerged from the session. One was called P.S. I Love You.
As I write this letter, send my love to you. Remember that I'll always be in love with you. Treasure these few words till we're together. Keep all my love forever. P.S. I love you. Send my love to you. Remember that I'll always be in love with you. Treasure these few words till we're together. Keep all my love forever. P.S. I love you.
One of the other numbers at that session was Love Me Do. At this stage, they weren't sure which one to make the top side. Now, here's Bob Wooler.
I had a little say in this, by the way. I'm sure George Martin did, because one of the numbers was P.S. I Love You. Now, Peggy Lee had a number out, which was a sort of standard, P.S. I Love You. Well, maybe the Beatles didn't know about this number, but we were aware that there was a number called P.S. I Love You. And perhaps this would have been a confusion, so Love Me Do went out on the top side, and that was a logical number, especially as it had the harmonica feel. Now, it was John's major contribution to that record.
George Martin.
Although I thought it was quite a good record, I didn't really think that the song had very much to offer. And, of course, in those days, I didn't think that they could write the necessary hits. They had shown no evidence of it at all. They'd shown me their own compositions, which weren't very good. And I was scouting around looking for material for them all the time. I was convinced I had a hit group on my hands, if only I could get the right songs. And couldn't find anything better, so I reluctantly agreed to release Love Me Do as a first one.
Love me do, oh, love me do.
The rest of the world had to wait to give their verdict until the official release date, October the 5th, 1962. For more about that record, what happened when they started to appear on TV and radio, and how they got their first number one, listen to part three of The Beatles Story.
Surely be learning. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of